welcome to Your Amigo's Christmas Special Podcast. We're here with fellow Your Amigo, Kala Sridhar. We're going to talk about bladder cancer today. So, Kala, welcome. Happy holidays. Merry Christmas. Appreciate you joining us.
Thank you for having me, guys. Same to you.
So, yeah, sort of a year-end summary of bladder cancer. I suppose, do you want to start a non-muscle invasive and go forward, Tom? How do you want to do this?
Kala, how would you like to do it?
Yeah, you're the guest.
I maybe would like to start with the metastatics, where that's the space I stay in a lot. So that would be really...
We'll start with a home game.
Did anything important happen in metastatic bladder cancer this past year, Kala?
That's a tricky one. Let me think about that. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the most exciting and sort of stunning data really came from Tom's EV-302 study. This was really exciting. It was practice changing. I think the standing applause at ESMO was really something else. And I think, Tom, you did a really great job. I'm sure it was a bit disruptive in the middle of the presentation and all. But this was really, really exciting. And I think part of the excitement stems from the fact that we've been trying to sort of dethrone GemCis for many years, right? And we just haven't been able to do it for one reason or another. And I really liked your shout out, Tom, to all the patients that were involved, not only in this trial, but in the trials before that led us to this sort of momentous point of finding sort of a new standard of care. So really, just to recap, EV-302 took the combination of EV plus Pembro and compared that against GemCis.
Don't worry.
Santa Claus. Santa's calling.
Okay, so no worries. I think someone's calling about the trial because it's... anyways, so in terms of median overall survival, 31.5 months versus 16.1 months, 12.5 months versus 6.3 months for PFS, and objective response rate 68 versus 44%, and CR rates there 29 versus 12.5. So this is the data that we haven't seen ever. In this disease. So I think that's where I'll start. And that was really, really great data.
So Kala, question. I mean, is there anybody, I guess, aside from absolute, say, IO contraindications, anybody you're not going to give this regimen to? And what percent of patients is that? Is it 5% who can't get it? Is it 15? What's that number?
Yeah, I think it's a really low number of patients who can't get this regimen. I think maybe 5%. I think I would at least like to try it, right? I think that, patients are hearing about this regimen and it really has a win across the board. Hazard ratios are really low, like, 0.47, 0.49. I think this is the best treatment. I mean, we really need to offer it to our patients if we have it available. I mean, I think, of course, maybe we can talk about access, but that's going to be... Sure. The big question coming up. But I think I would try to offer it to everybody. And then keeping in mind, too, this regimen of EV plus Pembro is already approved in the U.S. for cis unfit patients. So we already know you can give it to a patient population that is not perhaps the most robust.
So do we need to develop, like we did with cis and carbo or others did, eligibility for the regimen? Or is that kind of out the window because with modifications, et cetera, most people can tolerate it?
I think it's a great question. I would probably say that I think we need to develop very careful and perhaps somewhat stringent toxicity modification protocols. I mean, that needs to be out there for everybody, academic community, for nurses, nurse practitioners, patients, and everyone, just so we're actually managing the toxicities of this regimen well. I think that's first and foremost, and that's sort of immediately relevant because this regimen is out there already. In some context. And I think beyond that, then we will then potentially be in a position to say, well, maybe there are subsets of patients in whom you absolutely would not give this treatment to. But I think it's going to be a really small population given the strength of the results we've seen.
Yeah. Brian, my take I think the data is pretty strong and I think it's transformative. From a patient's perspective, you clearly would want to have this combination. I think it supersedes what's gone before it. I think my clinical experience and those of the people, I'm actually with some folks at the MD Anderson today, and they've been using it as well. And, you know, we went through some cases that they've used, and I've spoken to friends in Europe who recruited patients in the trial. And I think we're seeing this sort of these durable remissions in patients, which is unusual in urothelial cancer. Mm-hmm. We're also now talking a lot about how long and how much treatment patients need. And I think pretty much everyone feels that the pembrolizumab keeps going for 2 years. But the issue is how much EV are we able to give? And I think it really is patient specific, and some patients tolerate treatment better than others. There's a skill to giving the combination, but there's a skill to giving chemotherapy as well.
I'll ask you while Tom's apparently answering the phone. What do you think the next step is? So we're going to see a bunch of EV pembro plus drug X trials, right? Brad McGregor presented some dual ADC data at ESMO, whatever that last meeting was.
Yeah.
Are we going to see EV plus whatever, or what do you think is more important? Trials that are going to try to limit therapy or give it intermittently, or I don't know, you know, give it more creatively. I know it's going to move into different settings, but focusing on the metastatic setting.
Yeah. So focusing on this setting, I mean, I think the concept of de-escalation is kind of interesting and perhaps exciting, you know, whether we can use things even like ctDNA that's sort of bubbling in mm-hmm. the, you know, to say, well, you've got maximal reduction in ctDNA. Maybe this is a point when you go from EV pembro to maintenance, quote, you know, quote unquote maintenance pembro. And then maybe if you're seeing a rise in ctDNA, do we look at a re-challenge type strategy, right? Do you reintroduce EV at a later point? I think something about giving this drug safely, giving it for as long as it's benefiting patients and limiting toxicity is important. I think we, along the same lines, probably need to look at different dosing strategies, perhaps in patients who have toxicity issues. We know from the phase one trial, we saw responses at the 1 milligram. We saw even responses at 0.75. And I think this is important for people to know and patients to know so they report their toxicities and they don't end up, you know, having major problems. I think the data that Brad McGregor presented looking at combinations is very exciting. And I think that is definitely a step looking ahead, keeping in mind a little bit that, you know, we are using up our options down the line, right? So I think the other next question, or even the question that's before us right now, is what about sequencing? You know, what if a patient gets adjuvant Nevo? You know, what about after EV Pembro? Yeah. Do they get Gemcis, or do you ever reintroduce an immune checkpoint inhibitor later on, or how does that all work? I think we need some information. We need some studies to help us understand that a little better.
I mean, in RCC, we have preliminary data that sequential PD-1 inhibition doesn't work, or at least PD-1 followed by PD-L1. What would you do in a patient who fails adjuvant Nevo, recurs, say, I don't know, pick a time frame? Would you give them the benefit of the doubt and give EV Pembro given the data, or is there a time, you know, they have to have been a year off therapy?
Yeah, I think it's going to come down to a time frame for me. So I think at a minimum 6 months, you know, before I'd even consider like EV Pembro. Before that, I would probably just go to something like EV, especially if they've received neoadjuvant Gemcis, and then they're following that treatment paradigm, right?
Neoadjuvant. Carla, can I ask you a question?
Sure.
So let's say someone's got adjuvant Nevo, mm-hmm. and let's say they progress on adjuvant Nevo.
Mm-hmm.
You're saying you might not give EV Pembro then?
Yeah, I might. You know, I'm a little bit divided. I tend to think about giving EV and, you know, because that's sort of the chemo IO EV sort of thing. That's sort of the thinking that I'm sort of going on. But you could argue that there's such synergy with EV plus Pembro that does that, you know, giving the two of them together, would it boost anything? I don't know. I think
Does it worry you? I mean, I think the synergy conversation is complicated. I think there is. My feeling is it's clearly additive, and we're seeing these long, durable remissions. I feel there's something slightly unusual going on. We certainly didn't see it with chemotherapy and immune checkpoint inhibition. Whether it's synergy or not, I'm not sure. If we start curing lots of patients, then perhaps that is the case. And of course, we all hope that's complicated issues. The other thing, Carla, is what do you give with patients progress on EV Pembro? What's your standard of care?
I would at this point give Gemcis Gemcarbo because that's all that I would have available. I guess if they're FGFR positive, you could maybe mm-hmm. out, you know, something like Erda. That's sort of where I would go.
Brian, should we move on?
Yeah, let's move on. Kala, do you want to, since you mentioned the refractory setting, what's in the last
year? Should we talk about 901? We should talk about 901 and Nevo Genesis at the same
time. Yeah, I mean, the only thing I was going to ask about 901 is, I guess, I mean, let's put access aside, which will be hugely important, but is there a patient that you'd give chemo Nevo to and not EV Pembro?
You know,
what does that look like?
It's a really tricky thing, because I think that EV Pembro can be given to people who have, you know, creatinine clearance of 30 and above, right? So it lacks nephrotoxicity. It's quite a widely applicable regimen. So to me, I think, you know, the situations where I couldn't give EV Pembro are they're probably access related, right? And patient who can't get EV Pembro potentially couldn't get Gemcis Nevo either, right? So that's Tom, sort of the thinking.
Can you think of a patient?
Two things. Number one is no. I think if they're eligible for platinum-based chemotherapy, I think they're eligible for EV Pembro. And then the other question, which I'm sort of thinking, is I'm quite keen that we stop. I don't think platinum eligibility should define those patients that get EV Pembro.
Right.
It's a bizarre discussion to say we've got this new combination of drugs, or we've got this combination of drugs, and we've got to work out which patients get it based off a completely different combination of drugs. Like, certainly there'll be patients you can't give EV Pembro, you know, active autoimmune disease on steroids, you know, all sorts of reasons why you might not want to give it. But based off, you know, renal function because of cisplatin, carboplatin toxicity to give EV Pembro, that makes no sense to me. And that's
That was in the eligibility for the trial. I think they had to have a creatinine clearance over 30, just highlighting that there's not a nephrotoxic issue. Like, one of the biggest reasons patients, you know, can't get platinum or whatever is because of their renal issue. But there's no renal issues with EV Pembro, is all I'm saying. So, you know, from that standpoint, it's a pretty widely usable regimen. That's all that I was saying.
Education and training around skin tox, peripheral neuropathy, other adverse events. This is much more important about taking this combination forward rather than working out the carboplatin population and whether it overlaps with the EV Pembro. I think it's good to start with a blank bit of paper.
Agree.
All right. How about are we ready to move in the refractory setting?
I think we are. I think we should try and make it slightly more Christmassy. The podcast, Brian, can you do some singing or something in the background?
I can play some piano Christmas music. But Kala, now obviously the EV Pembro discussion we just had is going to reshape that refractory setting, right? And we've sort of hinted at that. But there was some other data, I think, with ERDA and some other things in the refractory setting. Anything stand out as practice impacting, practice changing?
You know, I think the only thing you mentioned, ERDA, I think it's sort of important to just highlight that, you know, we saw ERDA cohort one, where you saw a benefit of ERDA versus chemotherapy in third line, right? Post chemo and post IO. I've got Evie on the brain.
There's a song there.
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, I think there was a lot of enthusiasm. I mean, response rates were pretty high. I think upwards of about like 45% or something like that. And, you know, you're kind of going, okay, so let's move this drug up. And then we saw cohort two, which I think was a bit of a surprise in a way, where you now moved it up a bit and you did ERDA. You looked at ERDA versus Pembro, and that was a negative trial. So Pembro actually won that. It had longer duration of response. It probably maybe did a bit better than expected. And I think, so that's an important thing to think about, that if a patient is coming up to second line post, let's see, whatever they got frontline, if they're going to Pembro versus ERDA, I would kind of pick Pembro in that situation, unless there's some contraindication, obviously, to Pembro.
Yeah.
That was really interesting data.
The hazard ratio was 1.18 in that trial. And, there were two or three things that really struck me about that full trial. Firstly, congratulations to Johan and Arlene, and a huge effort. Like, they screened some extraordinary number of patients. I've got the number 8,000 in the back of my mind. I might be one decimal place out. But it's like this huge number of patients to enroll this this trial. And the whole team that took part in that, a massive effort. And now we have level 1A evidence for heavily pretreated patients, those patients that have had chemotherapy and immune therapy. And I think you're absolutely right. I think patients should be tested for FGFR. But then in that first trial, it seemed to work really well in the upper tract disease. And we were really excited about FGFR and upper tract disease. And now this new trial comes along. And it's really, I think it's important to remember that these tumors tend to be PD-L1 low. So the FGF positive tumors, only 10% are PD-L1 positive.
Right.
And so you would have thought Pembro would really struggle in that group. And everyone was expecting it to come home, and it didn't. What we saw was exactly what you said. The response rate was a little bit lower, but actually there was this tail on the curve, and the hazard ratio was 1.18. And what tells us two things, or three things. Number one, that PD-L1 biomarker clearly isn't picking the losers for pembrolizumab, because it stormed home and beat erdafitinib in a selected population. Number two is that the FGFR biomarker, we've got lots of questions now around that. Mm-hmm. You know, that's uncertainty. There always was uncertainty, but that remains for me. And I think that the third issue is it does demonstrate to us that immune checkpoint inhibition in terms of long-term durable remission is important, even in those patients with FGFR alterations. And before, we've been talking about, you know, patients in the avalimab trial, we looked at the FGFR population and it looked like the outcome maybe wasn't as good for avalimab. But I think right now in those FGFR population, I'm going to be giving pembrolizumab as, you know, as a, in all patients that I treat, I would like to give them an immune checkpoint inhibitor prior to giving them erdafitinib, because I think the chances of long-term durable remission are not really there with single agent erdafitinib.
So you're saying you'd give pembro based on the subset of patients with durable remission, because obviously those patients are benefiting the most, they do the best, but
I'm giving it off the 1.18 as well, Brian. You know, giving it off the one and the tolerability.
Is there a population if patients had bulky disease or, you know, sort of the classic patients that need, quote unquote, need targeted therapy more than immune therapy? Does that exist in this population? Would you say, boy, this patient has liver mets and is symptomatic and is ECOG 1.9. I better give ERDA because I'm going to get more bang for my buck and not have to wait. Is that true or not true?
The forest plot didn't seem to point towards that in the visceral metastasis. The forest plot also didn't point towards it in the upper tract disease.
How about just percent response and speed of response? That's sort of what I was getting at. I just don't know the data with ERDA if it's faster. I assumed it is, but maybe I'm wrong.
I think erdafitinib will be faster. And I think if you want to get control, I think that's entirely reasonable. And I agree. I think it's a good point, Brian, actually. I think you're right.
Thank you.
Yeah,
thank
no, you. I do. I think that's a good point. I really wanted to, Carl, anything on ERDA, or can I come back and ask you another question?
You know, the other thing I was just sort of thinking about, so in the THOR-1 study, you basically had chemo, and then you had IO, and then you gave ERDA or chemo, and a bit of me wondered if there was any permissive effect, if I can say that, of the IO prior to ERDA. I don't know if it did anything, but I just wondered about the two of them together based on Norse data, based on other things, you know, if that made any difference at all. That was sort of one of the things that I was thinking about. Then the other thing is that if I had to pick between something like ERDA and EV, let's say they didn't get EV before, but we're talking third line, ERDA versus EV, I personally tend to lean a little bit towards EV because I don't have to do biomarker testing, right? So I can just start the drug quickly. Those were just the points I wanted to make.
And the Norse trial was sotrilimab plus erdafitinib versus erdafitinib alone in the frontline setting in FGFR altered patients, cisplatin ineligible, a response rate of 56 versus 45%, I think. And overall, it wasn't clear whether the combination was clearly better. The OS was trending the right way, but it wasn't convincing. And I think J&J and the sponsor isn't taking that. Well, we haven't seen anything to show they're taking it forward. And I can see why, because it's going to be hard to beat EV Pembro in that space. And I don't think people are going to want to go down that route at the moment. It's hard to see that randomized trial versus EV Pembro without winning. So I think erdafitinib now is a single agent therapy as a third line, an established standard of care. I think it's very reasonable post EV Pembro in FGFR altered patients, because there's not so much data in that space. Although I agree with you, it's entirely reasonable to give Gemcis and Gemcarbo. Carla, I'm guessing that you're not going to have EV Pembro in Canada today or tomorrow. Under those circumstances, let's say you were able to give nivolumab and cisplatin, that fabulous 901 data that Mikael presented so beautifully. Ivalumab, 30% reduction in the risk of death in patients whose cancers haven't progressed on therapy, whereas, and that's probably about 50% of the population. I'm happy to have that debate if someone feels it's much very different from that. And then 901 has a ratio of 0.78, 22% reduction in the risk of death. Obviously, it's the entire population, so that hazard ratio is not quite as good, but it's a bigger population. The nivolumab study had maintenance nivolumab as well as concurrent, so some, if not, well, the majority of the benefit may be coming from that maintenance phase. But there was a CR rate of 20%, and there was a 10% additional bounce in response rates on top of that. And so the question to you is, if you had access to both regimes in a cisplatin-eligible patient, do you feel strongly that you're giving cisplatin-based therapy and nivolumab, or are you comfortable still giving maintenance nivolumab?
So, you know, I think it deserves being said that when these two trials, EV-302 and 901, were presented back to back, it was a bit difficult because it was a big wow for EV-302. But since that time, I've had a chance to sort of dissect the data of 901. And I think there are some really important take-home messages, if you will. I mean, I think that, you know, the response rates and CR rates were notable, but I think what was even more interesting was really the durability of that response. I think it was like 36 months or something. And that happened beyond the end of treatment, right? So there was a period, this whole concept of sort of treatment-free interval, or patients were not on any treatment, I think. So I think the data started to really come together for me and saying, well, if I don't get EV Pembro, which I probably won't, and, you know, till maybe the end of next year or later, then I think if I have a patient who's cis eligible, I would want to give them Nevo. I think giving IO upfront does have a benefit. And I think if I can get this durable response, I don't know who this patient population is. I would love to know, are like they lymph node only or whatever, but I would still prefer to do that because you and I both know that not everybody's going to get avelumab. So are not going to get avelumab.
So you've changed that practice. You're switching the cisplatin-eligible patients to nivolumab. Cisplatin-ineligible patients, you're going to go with avelumab.
I think you'd worry they would never make it to immune therapy, right? I think that's the concern. So, I agree.
Other thing that, you know, I have an interest in and I'd be curious about is, you know, we do from time to time the split dose GemCis. Does that help in the toxicity? And then the second thing that we did that we reported on a little while ago was the use of GCSF or Lapelga in all our GU patients. We started doing that around the time of the pandemic and big reductions in hospitalization and, you know, febrile neutropenia. So are there ways that we can do this just a little bit better than we do right now? Those are just the additional questions I had.
I think the shout out for avelumab is that I think some of the benefit from maintenance from the cisplatin nivolumab regime is coming from that maintenance phase. The PFS curve suggests that.
Yeah.
And it's obviously a relatively straightforward regime to give. I agree with the points you made about response being attractive for immune therapy, and I did say only a few minutes ago how important it was that patients get access to immune checkpoint inhibition. So I can see that being attractive for patients as well. It's going to be an interesting time. It would have been interesting to see what would have happened if EV Pembro hadn't come home in that way and wasn't there, how those two would have competed with each other. Because I can see, you know, I can see both sides of that discussion.
Mm-hmm. I can too.
Carla, you did a lovely piece of work with PET scanning, which was a huge investigator-initiated piece of work. It's a big randomized trial in the neoadjuvant setting. Me and Brian made a podcast last night with two GU docs, Brian, didn't we? I think it was a huge success. Would you agree?
It was a podcast called Two Onc Docs.
Yes.
And they do, they just sort of do on the advanced fellow, early faculty level, sort of board review type podcast. We did it on bladder cancer. But the concept, I think Tom's asking, because the concept of PET scanning came up and should we be doing it in bladder, et cetera. So maybe you want to describe some of the data you presented at ESMO.
Okay, sure. So the basis of this was really the fact that I think we understaged with standard CT scans, probably about 30% or so. So we took patients, 292 patients with muscle-invasive bladder cancer, T2 to 4A, N0 to 3, M0, and they had a CT scan and TURBT, and they were planned for either radical cystectomy or trimodality therapy. And this is one of the few studies where patients can go either way, so either radical cystectomy or trimodality therapy. And I think this is something we need to think about in our future neoadjuvant trials. Anyway, so patients were then randomized 2-to-1 to have an FDG PET, that was the experimental arm, and there were 194 patients there, or no FDG PET, that was the standard arm, 98 patients there. They could or could not have had neoadjuvant chemotherapy. It was really at the physician's discretion. And we actually did a sub-study where we looked at a PET scan after 2 cycles in patients who had PET avid disease at baseline to see if there's a correlation between PET response and DFS and OS. And it seems that there might be small patient numbers, so it was a bit exploratory. Anyways, patients had systemic treatment or not, and then went on to get radical cystectomy or trimodality therapy. And we were really looking for, you know, the proportion not receiving the expected treatment. They were stratified by T stage, nodal stage, whether they had a radical cystectomy or trimodality therapy. And basically, you know, patient characteristics were well balanced between the arms in terms of T stage, nodal, planned primary therapy. All of that was pretty well balanced. And what we found was that in the PET CT arm, about 11% of patients didn't receive the expected treatment compared to 4% in the no PET CT. So overall, PET CT patients were more likely to not have received the expected treatment compared to the no PET CT arm, but we felt that this did not hit statistical significance. When you look at the sort of finer details, radical cystectomy, about 50% in the PET CT arm compared to 65% in the no PET arm. Trimodality therapy was a little bit higher in the PET CT arm. I think this was really exciting for me. Neoadjuvant chemotherapy rates were 60% in both arms, which I think is stunning because we've been talking about numbers that are really, really low for a long time. So I think we're finally maybe drinking the Kool-Aid of neoadjuvant chemo. And palliative treatment, 10% in the PET CT arm versus 3% in the no PET CT arm. So, you know, although there was a trend towards change in management with PET CT, this didn't reach statistical significance. And so I felt that we would not recommend routine PET CT for all patients. There were 3 times more patients receiving palliative intent treatment with PET CT. Uptake of neoadjuvant, as I said, was great. And we need some long-term follow-up data, really even to look at how does it work between radical cystectomy and trimodality therapy. Of course, we've seen studies that suggest their outcomes are similar. And then further analysis as to whether or not there's subgroups within which this population may actually benefit from additional PET CT imaging. So that was the PET Muse study.
Carl, is it fair to say that PET scanning turned, it didn't affect survival, but it turned people away from having surgery?
Yeah, I think that's fair to say.
That's kind of, and is that important? Or, I mean, I guess you're sparing patients debilitating surgery they don't need.
Yeah.
Is that fair? Or do you think that's an overexertion?
Yeah, no, I think that's a fair statement. I think that, you know, maybe we're identifying patients who have more extensive disease who are not, you know, good candidates for surgery. I mean, should we be taking out bladders in patients who have distant metastatic disease? And I mean, that's a whole other question of local, you know, treatment directed at the primary and all of that. But I think it's an important question. It's a really, you know, it's quite a morbid procedure. And so
if we're not changing outcomes, should we be doing PETs or should we just stop it altogether? And my concern with PET scans is every time we do a PET scan, it just causes a lot of confusion. And I don't think it's ever really changed things very much for us.
I think that's a fair comment. I think that, you know, CT scans are actually pretty good. PET scans didn't change things. Do we need newer imaging? Do we need something else, ctDNA or something else? Probably yes. But for now, this was not, this was not a positive study.
So you're not really using PET imaging in any aspect of bladder cancer management? I mean, I'm sure there's always cases and this and that, but in terms of routine use to make decisions.
Yeah, routinely, we're not really PET scan. There are unique
situations. Agreed. Of course.
Yeah.
Agreed.
Exactly. Carla, two things before we call it a day. The DAD study, SGEV ADC combinations, the first ADC combination study, I think, anywhere in cancer. Mm-hmm. Brad McGregor presented it, 70% response rate. Some issues around the phase 1 design, as always in life. And the but the results were exceptionally good. I thought 70% response rate is high. What was your take-home message from that?
Yeah, I agree with you. I think that the response rates were high. I think it was reasonably well tolerated. I think that's really exciting. And I think it shows that we can do it. I mean, these two drugs have non-overlapping toxicities. They are completely different drugs, although they're both ADCs. So I think it brings in that factor that maybe when you have two drugs that are non-overlapping like that, you know, you could give them together. And if the response rates and perhaps the complete response rates are high and durable, then I think that's a strategy we need to really explore further. And I think the question will be, what again, you know, like with EV Pembro, do we keep both drugs going indefinitely for a long period of time, or do we have any de-escalation strategies, or should we be adding an immunotherapy onto that combination, making a triplet? I don't know, but really, really exciting. Lots going on, I think.
I talked about EV Pembro, EV Pembro sacituzumab triplet versus EV Pembro. Is that a study we should be doing, or are we premature?
I think we can go there. I mean, I think we've really, you know, we've shown over the last, I'd say, 5 years that we can find patients, we can accrue to trials, that, you know, we're doing okay. And I think it's time to ask that question. You have EV Pembro as a standard arm. And I think to add on another treatment, I think there's much more comfort in doing that now than maybe even there was 2 years ago.
And if you had to add one drug to EV Pembro, is that it? Or is there something else out there that you'd say, well, I'd do this, I'd prioritize this triplet?
A good question. I mean, I think that, you know, the two approaches would be, you know, adding in something, you know, SGEV plus Pembro, or are you going to add in a targeted therapy, or are you going to go down the road of something like, you know, one of those, you know, the newer immune type, like the anti-TIGIT, anti-TIGIT.
Right. So what would you add? You have unlimited resources.
I mean,
but you can only do one phase three.
Fair.
We're doing a phase three. We're doing the Volga trial,
right,
which is Durva-Tremi.
I'm just asking the question.
I know, I realized that. I just couldn't help myself. I apologize, Carla.
You're in charge of resources, not Tom.
Okay.
You can do one phase three, EV Pembro plus X versus EV Pembro. What's the X?
Yeah, I do like the SG idea. That might be my first choice, just building on what already. I think that's what, you know, there's a little bit of this stepwise thing where, you know, you have one and then you keep going. And so that's really exciting to me. All those drugs have efficacy. SG by itself, not that supremely exciting for me. So I think maybe it needs to be given in combination. I mean, the other drug that could maybe have a role, and I don't know, is if there's anything for like ERDA, like a targeted therapy, does it go in there? But again, I'm conscious of the fact that I don't want to put my options up.
So you're saying SG?
Yeah, I think
so. Tom, what do you think, or what were you going to say?
I was going to say the Volga trial is ongoing. So cisplatin ineligible patients, neoadjuvant, triplet therapy, randomized phase three, Durva-Tremi, infortumab vedotin.
What does that have to do with the question? I'm lost.
It's a triplet. You asked about a triplet.
No, I said EV Pembro plus X. What's the X?
Oh, well, no. Okay, well, let's substitute. I mean, let's not put EV Pembro. EV Durva, which is very similar, I hope. And then the X is tremelimumab.
So you'd add CTLA-4 inhibition.
I
know that trial's ongoing. Great.
You look, let me talk
you
about
can only CTLA. Add one. You can only do
I
one.
Realize that. Let me talk about CTLA-4 10 seconds, if I may. So in the Danube trial, there was a 10% bounce in response rate across all subgroups of patients. Okay. There was a increase or a reduction in the hazard ratio and improvement in OS by 10% in all the subgroups. We know that I think there is a role for CTLA-4 that is yet unexplored. Now, I'm not suggesting it's curing huge numbers of patients in metastatic disease, but I think in the neoadjuvant setting, it's justified. I'm okay with it.
You rag on CTLA-4 in kidney cancer, and now you're praising it like it's the second coming of something.
Hold on, I think you're misinterpreting. I think you're confused because you're misinterpreting what I'm saying. And you know what I'm really looking forward to? Yes. I'm really looking forward to the renal cancer Christmas podcast. Because then at that point, I'll unpick this issue for you in detail, Brian.
I've got to tell you,
I am looking forward to it a great deal.
All right, Carla, let's end. Carla, your favorite Christmas song, favorite holiday song.
No, 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 we can't do that. We can't do that yet. We can't do that yet. We have to talk about TAR 200 and TAR 210. And we just need to talk about the pretzel very quickly because there was Jim Catto presented some randomized data with, and there was also the TAR 200 program. And I think there's a Sunrise 1, 2, 3, and 4 mm-hmm. trial looking at the pretzel. And I think that this is a really exciting part of non-muscle invasive bladder cancer. We made the, during the Euroamigos meeting, we made a podcast on non-muscle invasive bladder cancer. We haven't got time to go through it now. We went through it in detail there. But I think that program is going to revolutionize and change non-muscle invasive bladder cancer. I think there's also Stiladrin and there's the superagonist IL-15. We went through all of those together. We haven't got time to do it now, I'm afraid, Carla. But I just do. I don't want to ignore non-muscle invasive bladder cancer.
Of course,
I think we're going to change for non-muscle invasive bladder cancer very, very soon. I'm very excited about it.
Agree completely. I think it's very exciting, and I think there's excitement across the spectrum of this disease. And
I'm so excited. I'm so excited.
Excellent. So am I.
Now, can I ask about Christmas songs?
Far away, brother, far away.
Please, Carla, please. What's your favorite Christmas song?
So my favorite one is probably Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas.
Oh, good one.
Yeah.
Who sings that one? Who does sing that one? Is that Mariah Carey?
Yeah, new, but the old, I think, was Frank Sinatra, if I remember correctly.
Which is that Mariah Carey song? Like, All I Want for Christmas is You. It's a slightly different song, actually. Yeah, but it's not my song. It's not my song.
What is your song, Tom?
I think I'm going to give a shout out to... Shane McGowan, who lead singer of the Pogues, a hero of mine, died a few weeks ago.
Right.
And Fairy Tale of New York. But actually, Shane McGowan, the Pogues, it took an Irish genius to write songs about London. He wrote the best songs about London. They're three, or Rainy Night in Soho, one of my favourite songs.
I'm sorry, are we talking about Christmas music still? I'm confused.
Well, I'm Fairy Tale of New York, but I'm just talking about his entire back catalogue, which, by the way, is fabulous. For those of you who've got a couple of hours or an hour to spare, the Pogues' greatest hits, revolutionary for me.
Carla, Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas.
No, Brian, what's your favorite?
Hold on, I'm giving some background on Carla's. I have the piano music right here. It's written by Hugh Martin and Ralph Blaine, who's from the MGM film Meet Me in St. Louis. Just a little trivia for the audience there. I think mine is The Christmas Song by Nat King Cole. It's my mother's favorite song, if you must know. But yes, it's my favorite song.
How does it go, Brian? Because I don't know it.
Chestnuts roasting on an open fire. It's that one. I'm not going to sing it for you. But
that's disappointing. I thought you might rise to that. And I'm really upset. I got really close.
Carla, have a great holiday.
I have to wait another year to get Brian to sing.
We appreciate the review and your time.
And you too. Happy holidays to you and all the best for the new year.
Beautiful, Carla. Have a good one. See you soon.
Take care, guys. Bye.